Heard it's a reaction to grief, to feel...
To feel horny?
Yeah. I wasn't going to say it, but... They kissed more, their bodies pressing together, and Caitlin knew that if they'd been alone in a room, their clothes would already be off. The feeling unnerved her, and she pulled away fractionally. He immediately did as well.
Should we keep walking?
He asked. Okay. They continued to the end of the cliff walk, then turned and walked into the wind back to the Kennewick Inn. There, at her car, Harry kissed Caitlin again, but briefly. He put a hand on the side of her neck. What now? She asked.
Maybe I could come see you at your motel room later? I could say goodbye.
Okay. I'm in 203.
It might be late. Alice is making dinner, and like I said, she likes to have me in the house.
Whatever. I'll be there. Back in her room, Caitlin lay on the freshly made-up bed and stared at the ceiling, striped with the low sun coming in through the motel's cheap Venetian blinds. She wanted to talk with Grace and found that she couldn't, that the words in her head weren't coming. The thought that she'd never talk with Grace again swept through her, and she cried again, then napped, waking in the dark. She was hungry, and remembered that there was a half a Monte Cristo in the mini-fridge from one of her meals at the diner. She ate two bites of the cold, congealed sandwich, then threw it out. Her stomach felt as small as a hard rubber ball. She switched on the television, found a station that was playing a Modern Family rerun, and left it there, the volume turned low. She answered texts from friends, from work, and from her mom and brother. She saw that her father had called and not left a message. It pissed her off. Why wouldn't he leave a message after his daughter, her twin sister, had died? Why wouldn't he tell her to call him immediately? She could hear his voice.
I didn't want to upset you more, Katie. I know what you must be going through.
And decided not to call him back. The Modern Family episode ended, and another one immediately began. She was tired again, and almost texted Harry to tell him not to come over. But no, she did want to see him one more time. But she wouldn't let him in. That thing that had happened on their walk now seemed like lunacy to her. Was she drunk from two beers? Yes, he was handsome and sweet, but her sister had just been killed and he was somehow involved. When and if he came by, she'd say she was exhausted, not a lie, and just say goodbye. She dozed some more, the television on, and woke to the sound of knocking on her door. She sat up and looked at the alarm clock on the bedside table. It was 11 o'clock. For a few seconds, she was entirely disoriented. The room was dark, except for the illumination of the wall-mounted TV, now showing a weatherman in front of a map of New England. She remembered that Harry was going to come over. She went to the door, ready to tell him that he shouldn't come in. The kiss from earlier flashed through her mind, his hand on her neck. She opened the door. In the exterior yellow lamplight, he looked pale and young. He was wearing a hooded sweatshirt, and he was breathing hard, a hand pressed against the side of his head as though he had a headache. "Hey, Harry," she said. "Sorry, I'm..."
"You should leave," he said.
"I should leave?" she repeated back, confused.
"You should leave right now. I think you're in danger."
The words sounded clipped, like he didn't have enough breath to say them fully. "What's going on? What happened?" She reached a hand toward him, and he flinched backward a little. He took his hand away from his head, and a trickle of dark blood ran down his cheek. "You're bleeding," she said.
"Am I?"
He looked at the palm of his hand, streaked in blood.
"Oh,"
he said. Then his knees buckled, and he fell into the motel room. Caitlin reached out, trying to break his fall, but he hit the carpeted floor hard, his head bouncing. And then he was still. Chapter 27. Now.
Do you know where Kennewick Hospital is?
I don't, Caitlin said.
You can follow us if you like.
Okay, sure, Caitlin said to one of the very young, very unconcerned EMTs after Harry had been strapped onto a gurney and wheeled into the back of the ambulance outside her motel. Two preteens a few units down had watched the whole ordeal from just outside their door, their parents occasionally poking their heads out to take a look. After Harry had collapsed into her room, Caitlin rolled him over, and he'd come to, his eyes wide with surprise and confusion. She took a look at the side of his head. His hair was dark and sticky with blood. There was an inch-long gash just above his right ear, the area around it puffing up.
I'm calling 911, she said.
Is it okay? I just fell and hit my head,
Harry said, beginning to sit up.
Yes, that's why I'm calling 911.
While they waited for the ambulance, Caitlin crouched and talked with Harry, now sitting against the wall. What happened? She asked.
There was a man. He was watching you.
What do you mean? Harry's brow creased, and his eyes seemed to empty out, as though he'd forgotten what he was about to say. Then he lightly shook his head and said,
I came here to see you. I walked, actually, because I didn't want Alice to hear me start the car. And when I got here, there was a man standing.
He pointed straight up with the index finger of his left hand.
A man standing over near the woods.
Where? On the other side of the parking lot, by the picnic tables? Caitlin could picture what Harry was talking about. It was really just a cluster of pine trees that separated the parking lot from Route 1A.
Yeah, he was by the picnic tables in the dark. But I could see him, and he was watching your window.
Are you sure?
Yes, I watched him for a while.
Where were you?
I was hiding behind a truck that was parked near the office.
His brow creased again, like he wasn't trusting his own words. Could you see who it was?
No, it was too dark, and he definitely didn't want to be seen. A car went by, and he'd crouch so the headlights wouldn't reach him through the trees.
Caitlin looked up at the cheap blinds in the window. They were pulled closed, but not tightly closed. There were some gaps between the plastic strips. Whoever had been watching might have been able to see her, and at the very least could see movement in the room.
Who do you think? It was whoever killed your sister, and probably my father. I don't know who it is, but you need to leave. I don't think you're safe.
How did you get hurt?
Oh,
he said, removing the towel from the side of his head and looking at the dark stain.
I chased him. He must have seen me behind the truck because he was suddenly leaving, heading around to the back of the motel, and I shouted, hey, and was running between parked cars and came down funny on my ankle, and then I was on the pavement. And my head.
What did you hit?
A car, I guess. I don't remember. Then I came to you.
You were very brave. Harry laughed, then grimaced.
I tripped and fell.
What were you going to do if you caught him?
I don't know. See who he was?
Did you get a better look at him when he took off?
Not really, but he looked funny when he was running. He was flapping, like he was trying to take off or something.
Flapping? The window suddenly filled with intermittent red light. The ambulance is here, Caitlin said, and opened up the door. She stood as the two EMTs entered the room, one dropping to his knees to take a look at Harry. I think he has a concussion, she said. He fell and hit himself on the head. The crouching EMT was already asking questions. She heard him ask Harry if he knew what year it was, but couldn't hear Harry's answer.
What did he hit?
The slightly doughy EMT who was talking with Caitlin smelled like bazooka chewing gum. I don't know. He thinks it was a car. He came here to see me, and he said there was someone lurking in the woods, or over by the trees, and he started to chase him, and that's when he fell.
Uh-huh. Did you see this person?
I didn't. He did. After they'd placed him on the gurney and wheeled him into the ambulance, Caitlin followed them. No sirens, just lights. As they drove what had to be less than 2 miles to a modern rectangular block of a building that looked more like a building in an office park than a hospital. She parked in the visitor's lot, then walked to the emergency room, where she was pointed to a seat in this small, overly lit waiting area, a TV bolted into the wall playing CNN. She sat still for a moment, listening to the woman at the check-in desk talking quietly on her cell phone. 1 week ago, she was living in Boston, worried about how to tell her mother that her relationship with Dan was over and wondering if her sister was going to spend the rest of her life chasing older men. And now she was here in Maine, waiting to fly with her sister's body back to Michigan and accompanying a stranger to a hospital. And someone had been watching her room. She was so relieved when she saw Detective Dixon walk through the double doors that she almost began to cry. She stood up and waited for him as he talked briefly and quietly with the receptionist. Then he came into the waiting area.
"What happened?"
he asked. He was wearing jeans and a flannel shirt with the sleeves rolled up. Caitlin sat back down and told the detective everything that had happened that night.
"Why was he coming to your room in the first place?"
the detective asked. "He was just coming to say goodbye."
"And he sounded sure that there was someone watching your room?"
"That's what he told me."
"Have you felt watched at all since being here in Kennewick? Any sense of being followed?"
Caitlin thought for a moment. "No, not really." Detective Dixon was scrolling through his phone for something, then showed Caitlin the screen. There was a photograph, a mugshot, actually, of a scruffy-looking man somewhere in his 30s.
"Does he look familiar to you at all?"
He didn't, and Caitlin said so to the detective.
"How about her?"
He showed her another picture, more pixelated than the previous one, of a blonde woman with a round face. The picture looked like it had been cropped from a larger shot. "No," Caitlin said, shaking her head. "Who are they?" Detective Dixon didn't answer because two more people had entered the waiting room. A curvy, middle-aged blonde that Caitlin instantly knew was Alice, Harry's stepmother, and a much older man, maybe her father, with a bald head and a white mustache. Alice had her arm through his, as though she was unable to stand on her own. "Definitely father," Caitlin thought, then remembered that Harry had mentioned an older man who worked at the bookstore, and she wondered if that was who it was instead. Alice and the old man both looked across the room at Detective Dixon, and then briefly at Caitlin. Alice, her mouth slightly open, her eyes blank, showed no reaction, but the old man seemed to look at Caitlin for a fraction longer than he should have. Maybe he'd met Grace, and he was confused by how much Caitlin looked like her. If it was the man from the bookstore, then he probably had met Grace. It was where she'd gone to meet Harry. The detective went to them, and the three talked quietly for a moment, then slid through the swinging doors into the emergency room, Dixon glancing back at Caitlin, mouthing the words, "Stay a moment," and holding up a finger. Caitlin stayed, though the adrenaline from earlier had worn off and she was now exhausted. Part of her just wanted to get up, go back to her car, and drive back to the motel. She had a big day tomorrow, flying back to Michigan, preparing for Grace's funeral. But the detective had asked her to wait, and besides, she wasn't exactly sure she wanted to go back to the motel alone. 30 minutes later, the detective returned and crouched in front of her.
"He's going to be fine, but he has a bad concussion," he said.
That seemed pretty clear.
"He wants to talk with you, but his doctor wants him to rest."
"That's fine."
"He's very insistent that you are in danger, though, so I'd like to have one of my officers escort you back to your motel room, if that's okay?"
"Okay," she said. "That sounds good."
"Great. 5 minutes, okay, Caitlin?"
The uniformed officer that arrived at the hospital was about 50 years old. He had jowls and a sparse blonde mustache. He followed Caitlin back to the Sea Mist Motel, parking the cruiser next to her car. Then together they entered her motel room. There was a quarter-sized bloodstain on the patterned wall-to-wall carpet where Harry had sat. She rubbed at it with the toe of her clog, but it had dried.
"You okay here by yourself?"
the officer said. I'll be fine.
Lock the door after I leave, and don't open it for anyone who's not a police officer, okay? And call immediately if you think something's strange, okay? We'll be swinging by all night for periodic checks. You're going to be fine.
She thanked him, and he left. She showered, then got into bed, thinking there would be no way she could fall asleep. But after texting her mother and brother about her arrival time for the next day, she curled into the fetal position, tucking one hand under her head and the other, wrist turned, between her breasts, the only way she could fall asleep, and within 5 minutes, she was out. She was awakened at just past 5 by a soft, tentative rapping on the door. She opened her eyes, emerging from a dream in which she was swatting at a bee's nest with a tennis racket, and for a moment had no idea where she was. Then she was up, and moving toward the door, worried suddenly that something else, something bad, had happened. She cracked the Venetian blind and peered out into the hazy light of the morning. She thought there'd be a police officer there, but instead it was the old man from the hospital, the one who'd arrived with Harry's stepmother. He saw her through the window, grinned and waved, but with a little too much eagerness. Her stomach buckled. Something must have happened to Harry. She cracked the door, aware she was wearing nothing but an oversized t-shirt. "Hello," she said.
"Caitlin McGowan?"
"Uh-huh."
"Sorry to show up like this. Harry sent me. He's,
Is he okay?"
"Fine, fine, we think. But he very much wants to see you, and so I came. I'm John, by the way. I work with Harry at the bookstore."
"Oh, right," Caitlin said, and opened the door a little bit more as the man inched forward. "Did he want to come into the room?" "I'll go straight there as soon as I get dressed," she said.
"Oh, right,"
he said, moving back a little.
"I'll let you do your thing. You don't need a ride?"
"No, I know where it is. I'll be right there." Caitlin almost shut the door, but not wanting to be rude, she opened it a little bit wider and said, "Thank you, John, for coming to get me. I appreciate it." He was still smiling, but his eyes were darting quickly from Caitlin's face to the frame of the door and back, almost as though he were measuring something. "Okay, then," she said, all her instincts telling her to slam the door. Instead, she began to push it gently shut, but before it closed, the man shoved against the door and caused her to stagger back, surprised, as he swung something at her and hit her in the throat. She took a ragged, painful breath, and he stepped inside and swung again. She reared back, and something hard clipped her nose. Next thing she knew, she was on her back, the world swimming before her eyes. She heard the door of the motel room shut, and then he was crouching above her. He touched her face, and she flinched. He said,
"Did he see me?"
I don't, who? Like a slightly exasperated teacher, he said, slowly,
"Did Harry see me last night? Did he tell you who it was he saw?"
Blood was flowing from Caitlin's nose and pooling into her mouth. She tried to scream and began to choke. The old man was looking over his shoulder, then he turned back and said,
"We'll talk later."
For one moment, she actually, blissfully, thought he was going to leave her, but he lifted his arm. She tried to scream again, and then it was blackness. Chapter 28. Then. Killing Bill had been easy. Jake Richter, going by John Richards now, had asked him where he'd been walking recently, and Bill, ever the explainer, told him how most days he walked down to Kennewick Beach, then followed the cliff path along to Kennewick Harbor, then back home.
"You see the same people every day?" "Nope, I hardly see anyone, except in July and August, but then I usually do a different walk."
A few days later, on a Wednesday, Bill asked Jake if he minded staying a little longer and doing the closing up. He was going to try to get a walk in before it got too dark. Jake had told him it wasn't a problem, then followed Bill outside into the cool evening, and watched as he made his way down toward Kennewick Beach. Jake locked the front door and left out the back, in case anyone was looking, even though it was highly doubtful, and took Captain Martin Lane down toward Kennewick Harbor. He walked casually, just out for some fresh air, he kept telling himself, then passed by the Kennewick Inn, its east wing covered by scaffolding while it got a fresh coat of paint before tourist season began. He found the southern starting point of the cliff walk, realized he was breathing heavily, and slowed his pace. If he timed this right, he'd meet Bill coming from the opposite direction. While walking, he fiddled with the homemade kosh in the pocket of his suit pants. He had made it a few days ago by putting a handful of quarters into one of his nylon socks. He hadn't learned much from his father, but he'd learned how to make a kosh, something his father insisted on carrying in his jacket pocket at all times. His father's had been filled with ball bearings, but quarters worked almost as well. The path ascended, views opening up, so that all of York Harbor and even some of Buxton Point to the north were visible in the gray, dusky light. He stumbled slightly on a slick rock and looked down, noticing that the laces were loose on one of his walking shoes. He was about to bend down, never an easy thing to do these days, and rectify the situation when he realized that he could use the untied laces to his benefit. He walked another quarter mile, the path had reached its highest point, and decided to wait for Bill to arrive. He'd killed before, of course. Edith Moss died so he could be with Alice. That moment marked the beginning of the best period of Jake Richter's life, but it was also the beginning of the end. He realized that later. Watching her mother die had obviously awakened something in Alice, because only a few years later she let her friend Gina die in the ocean, then got away with telling the police that she'd had nothing to do with it. Jake had known the truth, though, and he'd revealed that to Alice, thinking it would make them closer. It hadn't. Over the following few months after Gina died, Alice had grown distant and cold. She'd moved back into her old bedroom and started work as an office manager at a real estate company. Then, one day, she informed Jake that she had signed a lease on her own apartment.
"You can always move back here if you need to," Jake said.
"I won't need to," she said, then added, "but thanks for letting me stay as long as I did." Jake lived for a few years alone in the condo, occasionally allowing himself a fantasy in which Alice, tired of living by herself, asked to return. But he knew, deep down, that their relationship was over, had been over before she ever moved out. Nearing 60, he decided to retire early from the bank. His mortgage was paid off, and he bought a used 46-foot cabin cruiser. He sublet his condo and took the boat down to Florida, where he decided that he didn't like boating as much as he thought he would. He docked the boat in the Bahia Mar Marina in Fort Lauderdale and got a job renting beach chairs and umbrellas at the Atlantic Club. His hair had been thinning for a few years, and he'd been keeping it long to conceal the moss, but down in Florida, he got a buzz cut and grew a mustache. It transformed him, and he told himself he was a new person, a retiree who deserved some enjoyment in the remainder of his life. From his concrete bunker where the chairs and umbrellas were kept, he could see out onto a strip of packed beach. There was the occasional teenage girl, but most of the clients of the Atlantic Club were middle-aged or older, and none of them, not even the occasional enthusiastic widow, could begin to erase the memory of Alice Moss. He'd been in Florida 3 years when the Atlantic Club let him go. They told him that they thought he should enjoy more leisure time in his retirement years, but he pressed them for the real reason and was told that one of the guests had complained that he'd been staring at her 13-year-old daughter. He left without a fuss, finally sold the cruiser, and rented a cheap one-bedroom apartment in North Lauderdale. He bought a personal computer and, through various message boards, made contact with a slew of other men all interested in younger women, teenage girls mostly. He even messaged with some older women who were interested in younger boys. At least, he thought he was chatting to women. You never really knew, on the internet. He spent an enormous amount of time on the computer, but in the end it turned out to be an empty enterprise. He'd been looking for someone more like him, someone who felt that being with someone younger, teaching them all you knew, was the way to a better, larger life. It wasn't all about sex, it was about generosity, about the sharing of one's life force. No one really understood him. The other men just wanted to share pictures and talk about the beauty of teen girls. No one understood what Jake understood, that what he'd briefly found with Alice was akin to the fountain of youth, and that you could pass it along. Emma Codd had gifted it to him, and he had gifted it to Alice. He still had the pictures of Alice. They were his prized possession, and he'd handled them so many times throughout the years that they'd gone thin and ragged on the edges. He kept them flat and protected in the pages of a hardcover copy of Moby Dick on his bedside table. Sometimes he wondered if the pictures were a way back into Alice's life. She'd probably forgotten all about them. Maybe he could get in touch, remind her of their existence, maybe ask if she'd like to come down and visit him sometime in Florida. It would be blackmail, he realized, but it would be worth losing the pictures if he could just spend a little more time with her. He thought about it a lot, but it was only a fantasy. When he did finally get in touch with her, via her work email, he just asked her questions about her life. She was getting married, she told him. Another older man, and one with a young son. She still lived in Kennewick. They emailed back and forth. Alice's responses so rote and formal, it was as though they had never meant anything to each other. Years passed, and Jake began to feel old. He became sexually involved with a teenage girl, a runaway from Miami named Valeria, who spent a week with him in his apartment until one day a man showed up at the door, claiming to be the girl's brother. They looked nothing alike, and demanding $1,000 or he'd go to the police. He claimed Valeria was 15 years old, even though she'd told Jake she was 17. He'd paid up, reluctantly and shamefully. The incident haunted him for several months, Jake deciding to leave Florida altogether, until he spotted the brother entering a nearby apartment complex. Jake began to watch him regularly, discovered his name was Edgar Leon, and determined that he lived alone. One night, after staking out the Jacaranda Estates for several hours, Jake followed Edgar up to his second-floor apartment, knocking on the door 1 minute after Edgar entered. It was 2 in the morning. He worried that Edgar, because of the time of night, would be armed when he came to the door, but he wasn't. He was shirtless and yawning and opened the door wide. Jake's first strike with his cosh put Edgar on the floor. Jake straddled him and repeatedly hit Edgar in the head until it was clear he was dead. Jake felt better about himself after killing that cut-rate pimp. And he felt better about staying in Florida. He heard from his real estate agent in Maine that a long-term renter had just moved out of the Kennewick Beach condo he still owned, and Jake decided to sell. He was about to let the agent know when he got an email from Alice, now going by Alice Ackerson, and with a new email address. The email was short, just 2 perfect sentences. Jake, you ever think about returning to Kennewick? It would be nice to have an old friend here. Alice. The email was a thrilling surprise. He'd assumed that he never would hear from her again. So he'd returned to Maine, an easy decision to make, and moved back into his old condo. He was shocked to discover that the carpeting was dirty, 2 window panes were cracked, and the wood of the balcony had rotted. Still, he was near Alice again. They met in a diner the day after he'd arrived. She was older, a little softer, but otherwise unchanged. He couldn't help seeing himself through her eyes, though. The completely bald head, the skin damage, the white mustache. He didn't mind so much. He knew that he hadn't been summoned by Alice to resume their love affair. It was enough that, for whatever reason, he was needed.
"I was wondering if you could do me a favor, Jake," Alice asked, as soon as they were settled in a booth.
"Of course, anything."
She asked him if he'd volunteer to help out in her husband's used bookstore. She said it was because he needed help. He worked nonstop. But the more they talked, the more it became clear to Jake that Alice wanted someone to keep an eye on her husband.
"He's found someone younger in New York," she said, her voice flat.
"How do you know?"
"I saw the messages on his phone, and then suddenly they stopped appearing. He must have another way of getting in touch with her now, probably something in the store. You could help me find out if it's still going on."
"Okay,"
Jake had said.
"But are we pretending we don't know each other?"
"That would be for the best. Give him a different name. He'll never know."
"What if people around here recognize me?"
"They won't, Jake. You look totally different."
She'd been right. He hadn't been recognized by anyone, nor had he seen anyone he recognized. The bank had been two towns over, and the patrons from there didn't seem to frequent Ackerson's rare books. He went by John Richards now, and he liked the new identity. He liked Bill, too, for what it was worth, even though he did eventually find proof that he was involved with someone in New York. It turned out they'd been sending private messages through the store's rarely used Twitter account. Jake had stumbled upon it by accident after going onto the store's computer to look up a health condition. He'd been experiencing a strange twitching in his left arm recently, and he'd put in the letters T and W when Twitter popped up, landing him on the bookstore's page. He'd never seen much of Twitter. Bill was the one who maintained it, and he noticed that there was a message icon on the top menu bar. He clicked on it, and there it was, several back-and-forth messages between Bill and a Grace McGowan in New York. They weren't overtly sexual, but they were intimate. Most messages ended with "Miss you" from Bill, and "XOXO" from Grace. There was very little information on Grace McGowan's actual Twitter page. It seemed that maybe it existed only so that she could private message with Bill. But there was one picture of her, and she was very young. Early 20s, maybe. Around this time, Annie Callahan came to work at the store, a temporary arrangement because of a huge lot of books that Bill had recently bought. She was a local girl, somewhere in her 30s, and married to an out-of-work cod fisherman. She wasn't much to look at, Annie, one of those girls who had probably been very pretty for about 1 year of her life, back when she was 17. But the years of marriage to a perpetually unemployed alcoholic had taken their toll. Her face was pinched, her hair colorless and dull. She wore a carpal tunnel brace on her left arm. "Years of data entry," she said. But even with that bad wrist, she'd been an incredibly hard worker, managing to bring a semblance of order to the store that it had never had before, at least since Jake had started working there. Jake noticed that every time Bill thanked her for her work, or looked directly at her, she'd turn bright red, all the way from the dark roots of her hair down to her scrawny neck. She was in love with Bill. That much was obvious. Jake also noticed how gingerly she'd move around the store, especially after weekends, and Jake assumed that whatever damage her husband did to her was visible under her long sleeves and high-necked sweaters. Bill, with his Gregory Peck good looks and calming voice, was clearly her idea of a knight in shining armor. He barely noticed her, of course. Jake reported all his findings to Alice during one of her visits to the store when Jake was all alone. He told her about the full-fledged affair in New York, plus the smitten employee. Alice's face remained blank as she took in the information. She wanted to see the picture of Grace, so Jake found the one on Twitter and showed that to her.
"What do you think?" he finally asked.
"I'm done with him," Alice said.
"Are you going to ask for a divorce?"
Her brow furrowed, and she said, "I would never get divorced, but I'm done with him." That night, Jake lay in bed and thought of the different ways he could kill Bill. How easy it would be to make it look like an accident, especially if he could kill Bill during one of his walks along the cliff. He even thought that if the death looked suspicious, it would be incredibly easy to suggest to the police that Lou Callahan, Annie's violent husband, might have been involved. But mostly what Jake thought about was that he would be doing this for Alice. He didn't think he'd be back in her life any more than he was now, but it would be one last thing he could do for her. It would give him purpose. Annie stopped working at the store. One morning, she just didn't show up and didn't answer her phone. She came by in the afternoon with Lou, her husband, and said that she could no longer work there because Lou had picked up some work. She did all the talking while Lou, a goateed cretin, watched silently, glowering at Bill, who was oblivious. Jake put the bizarre scene in his back pocket. If Bill was gone, then Jake could twist the encounter to fit any narrative. It was something to consider. In the next few months, Jake slept less and less. He found he could survive on as little as 4 hours, but he still spent about 10 hours each night in bed, thinking about Bill, wondering whether he should tell Alice his plans. He finally decided not to, and building up a case against his boss. Bill was one of those careless men who was perceived as sensitive because he was bookish and reticent. But he had been hugely fortunate to marry Alice, and now he had replaced her with a much younger woman. He deserved what was coming to him. Waiting for Bill, Kosh hidden in his hand, was the longest minute of Jake's life. He heard him before he saw him, his boots scraping along the rocky path. Jake began to walk as well, and rounded a twist, nearly bumping into Bill, who smiled and laughed.
John, what are you doing here? Thought I'd take a walk myself, and was hoping to run into you. Everything okay? You look pale. Yeah, I'm fine. Look, this is embarrassing, but my shoelace is untied, and I could get it myself, but...
Bill looked down, then bent at the knee, saying,
Not a problem at all. I got it.
As he was knotting the laces, Jake quickly looked back down along the path to make sure they were alone, then lifted the kosh and brought it down with all his strength on the crown of Bill's head. It made a thunking sound, and Bill, groaning, fell to his side. Jake went down on one knee himself and hit him 2 more times. He heard the skull crack. Jake stood up. There was no sound except for wind coming in off the ocean. Bill lay right on the edge of a steep drop to the rocky shore below. Jake tried to push him off with his foot, but couldn't quite manage it. He bent, and gripping Bill by his windbreaker, rolled him off the edge with both hands. His heart was pumping as if he'd just run a mile, but Jake's mind was clear. He decided to keep walking north along the path and exit along Micmac Road. There was less chance that someone would see him. If they did, they did. He'd say he'd been looking for his friend to go on a walk, but hadn't spotted him. They could never prove otherwise. But luck was on his side that day. There was no one else on the path, and Jake was back in the store before it had even gotten dark. Chapter 29. Then. Sleep had never been easy for Jake, not even when he'd been young. It came reluctantly, if at all, and departed easily, scared away by the first appearance of dawn light through the cracks in the curtains. For a long while, he found he could drink himself into a good night's sleep, but in his 50s, he developed acid reflux, at its worst after a night of drinking. He'd prop himself on pillows, and after several hours of a revved-up mind and the rising taste of bile at the back of his throat, he would sometimes manage a few pre-dawn hours. He quit drinking and found that Ambien helped for a period of time, till something in him began to resist the drug, and he'd lie in bed half awake and half spooked by visual hallucinations. He returned to moderate drinking and over-the-counter acid-reducing pills that sometimes worked and sometimes didn't. But after what he'd done to Bill on the cliff path, Jake wasn't sure he'd slept at all. He must have, a little bit, if you wanted to call those thin excursions into semi-conscious states a form of sleep. The worst part of his recent nights was picturing Bill, who'd offered him both a job and some semblance of friendship, groaning at his feet. And he kept hearing the sound the kosh made when he brought it down on Bill's skull, like an icy puddle cracking. Jake reminded himself that Bill had been a selfish man, so caught up in his books that he barely paid attention to the people around him. Besides, he'd done this all for Alice. He'd done what she wanted. And now Harry was back, and Jake wondered if Harry had factored into all of this, if Alice wanted to start a new life with Harry. Lying awake, he'd try to remember the time with Alice immediately after Edith had died. It was comforting, but Jake found his mind wandering further back, thinking of Mrs. Codd, his neighbor, all those years ago. She'd been dead now for over 50 years, and Jake often wondered if anyone else ever thought of her. Her sons, maybe, if they were still alive. Sometimes he thought of his parents, both long dead as well, his father from drinking at the age of 55, and his mother from congestive heart failure 10 years later. He'd kept to his promise and never gone to see either of them after that first year of college, although he'd sent his mother updates whenever he moved addresses, and sometimes she'd write back. She'd written him when his father died, describing the circumstances, but never mentioning that she'd like for him to visit. He wouldn't have, even if she'd asked. After she died, he'd received a letter from a lawyer, saying that there was some furniture and other possessions that he might like to have. Jake never responded. A second letter arrived, but that was it. He'd felt nothing at the time, but as he'd gotten older, his anger at his parents had increased. Why had they brought him into the world if they had no interest in loving him? It had made him what he was, of course, successful, able to find his own love and happiness, unburdened by guilt. But why had they done it? If he could go back in time, he would ask his mother that question, just to see her squirm. Jake wasn't sure he'd be able to go to Bill's funeral, but knew it would look strange if he didn't. He went, but avoided talking with Alice, who surely knew that he had done her bidding, and was shocked to see Grace McGowan, it had to be her, sitting quietly by herself at the back of the church. The sight of her scared him, somehow, as though she knew what had happened. But that wasn't possible, was it? She was here because she loved Bill, and she was hiding in the back of the church, not wanting to be seen. But then she'd actually come into the store. Jake watched from the back room as she talked with Harry, and then they exchanged numbers. After she left, Harry told him that she was looking for a job. He was alarmed, wondering if she knew anything, even though he thought that was impossible. But it gnawed at him. On the Wednesday evening after the funeral, Jake closed up shop and went and sat on the bench across from the village inn to read that day's paper. It was something he did sometimes when the weather was decent. No one noticed an old man on a bench. But that night, he'd done it hoping to see Grace, maybe find out where she was living. Many cars drove by, plus a few pedestrians. He was about to give up when a couple came out of the village inn. He recognized Harry right away, and then he recognized Grace. Had she gotten a room at the village inn, and had Harry been in there with her? It was a definite possibility, but maybe they'd just had a drink at the bar. They turned left, up the hill, and Jake followed them at a distance, up to Barb Whitcomb's place, where they stopped and talked some more. Jake, not willing to risk being seen, turned back. That next afternoon, Jake talked with Barb, sidling up next to her as she was coming back from the Cumberland Farms with her Megabucks ticket. he found out that she'd been advertising one of her spare rooms on the internet, and that the girl, Grace McGowan, had come up from New York City the previous Friday. "She cries in her room, that much I can tell you. I don't ask what's going on because it's none of my business."
"You think she's here because she knew Bill?"
"You'd know more than me," Barb said. She told him she was leaving the next day to visit her adult daughter, who lived on the Cape. "She's back in rehab, telling me she's cured, of course, and don't I want to come down and see it for myself?"
"Maybe it will take this time."
"That's what she says, John. I'll believe it when I see it." That night, he didn't sleep at all. He kept thinking of Grace, wondering why she was still in town, why she was clearly after Harry. He wanted to call Alice, but knew that would be a mistake. They talked frequently, but always at the store when no one else was around. She didn't want anyone to know about their connection. He paced the condo, then at dawn he got dressed and made a new cosh using a sock and quarters from his change bowl. He showered, then dressed for the day, pushing the coin-filled sock down deep into his suit pants pocket. That night, after the sun had set, Jake went up the hill to Barb's house. There was no good place to sit and watch, so he stood quietly in the stand of birches across the street, his eyes on the bowed-out second-floor windows. He thought he caught movement a few times, maybe a shadow passing across a curtain, but he couldn't be sure. But if he stayed here long enough, he knew he'd eventually see Grace either arrive or depart. Either way, he could get to her. He shifted from leg to leg and shook his arms to keep his circulation going. He'd slept a little bit in the back office of the store that day, nodding off in the wooden swivel chair. He dreamt he heard Bill's voice, slicing through the wind, telling him to wake up, but his eyes were glued shut and he couldn't open them. He was worried he was going to fall off the cliff and into the cold water below, but he couldn't open his eyes, and he couldn't stop walking forward, feeling for branches that would keep him on the path. Bill's voice got closer, then farther away, and Jake jerked awake only when his elbow slipped off the arm of the chair. He'd been standing and watching Barb's house for less than an hour when the front door opened. He stood as still as possible. The slender figure, too tall for Grace, he thought, walked from the dark house into the light of a street lamp on the sidewalk. It was Harry, which wasn't surprising. How long had he been inside? Had they been fucking, or had she been telling him about his father? Probably both. Jake waited a few minutes, then crossed the road to the house. He tried the door, but it was locked. Looking back over his shoulder, he pressed the doorbell. Two chiming notes sounded from within the house. He pulled the sock from his pocket and waited, hoping she'd swing the door open freely, expecting to see Harry again. Instead, she cracked the door open 3 inches and peered out. Jake pushed against the door with all his strength, catching her unaware, and she stumbled back.
"Hey,"
she said, right before he hit her in the jaw with the cosh, dislocating it. She crumpled instantly to the floor like a knocked-out boxer in the ring. Jake stayed standing, his heart tripping in his chest, wondering if the blow had killed her, but her chest was still lifting and falling under her striped shirt. The door was open behind him, and Jake pushed it almost all the way closed with his foot. Then he crouched over Grace McGowan and hit her several times on the side of the head. Chapter 30. Now. Harry had no memory of being at Caitlin's motel room, but he did remember the ambulance ride, and he knew that he'd tripped and fallen, even though it was a fuzzy memory. There was a persistent, low-frequency ringing in his ears, and the inside of his head felt swollen, almost like a balloon had been blown up inside his skull. Earlier, one of several doctors who'd come in to question him had asked him what town he was in, and he was totally surprised that he hadn't immediately known. She'd moved on to other questions, but before she left, he'd said,
"Kennewick. I'm in Kennewick, Maine."
She'd smiled and told him that was correct. Detective Dixon came by, and Harry told him that Caitlin was being watched. It was all he really remembered. Later, he opened his eyes and saw Alice staring at him so intently and with so much love that he closed his eyes again, pretending to fall back asleep. He could smell her perfume in the room, and he heard a soft, deep voice in the background that sounded like John Richards. He kept his eyes closed. He'd been awkward around Alice ever since they'd had sex, the night before that terrible morning when he had discovered the dead body of Grace McGowan. After that long, surreal day, after being questioned repeatedly by the police, both local and state police detectives, Harry said to Alice,
"About what happened last night."
She looked at him with a tired, blank stare. He noticed, not for the first time, that the surfaces of her eyes, from some angles, appeared almost flat. It gave her a distant gaze even when she was looking right at him.
"You want to pretend it didn't happen," she said.
A little bit startled by the accuracy of her statement, Harry said,
"No, yes. I just think it shouldn't happen again, is all."
"Sure, it never happened," she half smiled.
That was all they had talked about it. And Alice had not returned to Harry's bed, even though Harry, in the moments between sleep and wakefulness, found himself replaying the memories of Alice's naked body, the way she had controlled him, her voice in his ear. Those images fought with the constant image of Grace, dead on the hallway floor, one side of her face collapsed and ruined, the other looking just like she'd looked in real life. And he'd begun to obsess over every moment they had spent together, every word they had said during the short time they had known one another. What he kept coming back to was that Grace had come to Maine for one reason. She had come because she believed that Alice was responsible for his father's death. She'd been convinced of it. And now she was dead, and Harry couldn't help but think that it meant she'd been right. The days and nights following Grace's death seemed interminable as Harry waited to hear about an arrest. He tried to talk more to Alice about Annie and Lou Callahan, but all she would say was that she was sure they were involved and that she didn't want to talk about it. He also badgered Detective Dixon into repeated meetings. He felt better talking, again and again, about the events that had transpired over the last few days. And it was after one of those fruitless conversations that he'd met Grace's sister at the police station. Caitlin looked so much like Grace that when he first saw her, he thought he'd seen a ghost. Her hair was a little different, as was the way she held her body, but her mouth, her eyes, they were Grace's eyes, and Harry, knowing it was insane, felt as though she was in Maine just so he could have a second chance. That she was there for him. Harry, in his hospital bed, the lights now dim and the room empty, tried to focus on the man he'd seen outside of Caitlin's motel, but the focus kept slipping away from him, like two magnets that repel one another. Every time he felt like he could see the man hiding in the dark, the image would push itself away. All that remained was the terrible fear he'd felt. Someone was watching Caitlin. She needed to leave Maine. The pressure in his head increased, and he opened his eyes. He knew Alice was close, probably out in the waiting room. He'd seen her earlier, hadn't he? Then he remembered that he'd also heard John's voice in the background. Why was John there at the hospital? It wasn't totally surprising, but it was a little odd. It was so late at night. Had she gone to get him after she'd heard word that Harry was in the hospital? Why hadn't she called Chrissy Herrick instead? He closed his eyes and listened to the sounds of the hospital, the undercurrent of humming machines, the distant chatter from the nurse's station. Then he heard rushed footsteps along the linoleum floor, a progressive clack, 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 some nurse in clogs hurrying toward a patient in need. His eyes suddenly opened on their own, the sound of the footsteps bringing back the woolly memory of the man running away the night before. Something had been strange about it. What had it been? Then Harry remembered. The man he'd chased had looked like he'd been flapping his wings, and there was something else. Yes, it was the flat slaps of dress shoes hitting the asphalt. The man must have been in a suit, unbuttoned, and it was the suit jacket that was flapping as he ran. A too big suit jacket. And he'd been wearing dress shoes as well. And Harry suddenly was sure that the man watching Caitlin's motel had been John. He knew it. And it wasn't just the suit, John's constant uniform. It was also the size of him, the slope of one shoulder in the dim light. There was no doubt. But why? If John was the one watching Caitlin, then he was the one who'd killed Grace and maybe his own father. It didn't make sense. John was an old man. Would he have been strong enough to overcome Bill and also Grace, a young woman? If he'd had a weapon, sure. Harry, in and out of fuzzy consciousness, kept imagining John's strong hands and wiry frame, his body concealed by the loose-fitting suits. A nurse came in to check on him.
"Awake, I see," he said. "On and off. How's the head?"
"A little fuzzy, but getting better."
"You'll be glad to know your mother is still here. We told her to go home, but she insisted."
"My stepmother," Harry said.
"Oh, right. She's very concerned."
"She's awake?"
"No, she's sleeping now. There's a couch in the waiting room."
When the nurse left, Harry dozed for a few minutes, then woke again, still thinking of John. What did he know about him? Not much, except that he was local, having spent many years in southern Maine. He lived on Kennewick Beach, in one of the dated condos up near Buxton Point. Bill had pointed it out to Harry once during a walk. This was right after his father had brought John in full-time at the store.
"What's his deal?" Harry had asked Bill. "He's just one of those guys who needs to be working, I guess. But I like having him around. He's harmless."
Harry's temples throbbed, and he closed his eyes. Bright splotches of color spread and contracted under his eyelids. He was exhausted again, despite the rising anxiety, and he fell into a thin, disturbed sleep. When he woke, Alice was over him, her face registering the same overly concerned look from before.
"Hi, Alice," he said,
the words clicking a little because his mouth was so dry. How long had he slept?
"Hi, sleepyhead," she said. "How do you feel?"
"Okay. Thirsty."
Alice brought him a cup of lukewarm water.
"Dr. Roy's coming soon. She said she thinks you can leave this morning."
"Oh, good," Harry said.
He remembered being convinced that it had been John outside of Caitlin's motel, and said,
"Is Detective Dixon here?"
"I don't think so. Why?"
"What about John? Was he here last night? I remember hearing him."
"He was here, but he's back home now. Want me to call him for you? Have him come back?"
Alice pushed a lock of Harry's hair off his forehead, and the touch of her fingertips on his skin caused a ripple to race down his spine.
"No, I just..." "How long have you known John, Alice?"
Alice blinked. "Years, I guess. Since I was a teenager."
"You knew him when you were a teenager?"
Harry asked. Alice sat back on her chair.
"He was married briefly to my mother. You knew that, didn't you, Harry?"
Harry didn't say anything right away. Was he still confused from the concussion? Had he somehow forgotten that Alice and John had been related?
"I didn't know that, did I?"
he said.
he was your stepfather?
Alice laughed. I never thought of him that way. No, he was just someone who married my mother. I didn't know him well at all.
And my father knew this too?